Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. Our program today, Mayor Ashley Swearingen on putting Fresno back to work and the jobs high-speed rail will bring and what you need to do to land one of those jobs. Plus, California government, what will it look like in the future? Also, we ask the question, what role should the federal government play in education? First, our interview with Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen. Fresno has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, above 15%. High unemployment and uneducated workforce, not new issues for Fresno. Mayor Swearingen tells us why we now have the opportunity to fix those problems. Mayor Swearingen, thank you so much for joining us on Valley Edition.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, over the last couple of weeks, information was released that really underscored what has been, you know, a problem that has dogged this region for decades, and that is too many people lacking in adequate education for today's job market and the lack of jobs for people who do have an education. Will we ever be able to adequately address this problem, you think?
I, first of all, want to say how important it is that we shine the light on this issue, because you're absolutely right. This is a decades-old issue, in not just in Fresno, but throughout the San Joaquin Valley. And I've said many times, if we did nothing else with our economic development plans but focus on workforce development, our adult working population, improving the education and the skill level of the people looking for work, and frankly, even those who may be in jobs, but they have no opportunity to advance because of the lack of training or education. If we did nothing but focus on that issue, and we did it really well for about 10 years, we would see a thriving economy at the end of that 10-year period. I firmly believe that we can tip the scales on this issue, but I feel like it's only been in the last probably 5 to 7 years that we actually really started to focus in on this part of the equation of job creation. Most of the time, what we talk about and what we think about is the business side, which is how do we make businesses more competitive so that they add jobs that then can be filled. And while that still is an incredibly important part of the work we have to do, the really biggest challenge we have is on the qualified workforce side of things, and that bears out in this Brookings report.
What do we do? Are we doing some things now that you think will bear fruit in this area?
Absolutely. And there's a couple of programs that I would point to as success and great potential that have to be scaled. For example, the first is a program called Learn to Earn that we initiated with all of the adult education training providers in the greater Fresno area. There are 24 public and private institutions in Fresno that provide adult education, whether it be high school diplomas, GEDs, or some kind of basic vocational training for people who have who need to develop their skills. Cesar Chavez Adult School comes to mind, Fresno City College, Heald College, places like that. So we've brought all of those institutions together and work with their frontline career education staff people, the people who every day are talking to people who've dropped out of school and trying to get them back into school. We picked their brain for several months on what the barriers are that are keeping people from accessing the education and the training that we have today. And based on their input, we put together a program called Learn to Earn. Part of it is public awareness and promotion and telling people who have dropped out of school or who have not had success in education, it's never too late. You can always go back. Many, many people, even right now today, are sitting in a classroom that maybe failed the first couple times around, and they're working towards some kind of a certificate or a degree. They can do it. You can too. So there's a promotional side of it. And then there's also an effort involved to lower just the complicated process that it can that is involved in getting somebody enrolled in school and involved in a program. It can be very overwhelming to walk onto a campus like City College or some other place and not know what to do if you don't have any background in accessing these kinds of educational institutions. So we're streamlining that that process for people, making it easier, and then convincing them that they can, in fact, get back to school. So we're just ramping up those efforts, and I have great hope for that work.
Well, part of it is, too, once we do provide the services, at some point, and I think we look at this problem and the fact that we've had it for such a long time, individuals are going to have to take responsibility and step up and say, you know what, I don't like where I am right now. So part of it has really got to be on them to say, you know, I want to improve.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's why one major component of Learn to Earn is focused on a communication campaign that sends that message that, number one, it's never too late. Number two, it is up to you. You can do it. And it doesn't mean if you get, for example, your high school diploma and you haven't had it up to this point, or you get some additional vocational training to advance your career position, it doesn't mean that life all of a sudden gets easy. We know that it's still a really hard road, but many people have traveled down this road. Many people have started from a place of having really no educational background. They've worked their way through. They found a way. They've made it. And it takes character, and it takes a commitment to getting through a program and just staying with it, right? So it's not that it makes life all of a sudden easier, but without even a basic education, you don't even get through the first screen on a job interview process. So you have to get through just basic education.
And we've seen that the recession has directly impacted this area, and also our efforts to do exactly what you say. For example, we know that we need more nurses, but due to budget cuts, we can't hire the teachers to teach the nurses. But on the other hand, part of that same dilemma is that we have less money, so we have to cut our budgets. People don't want to raise taxes. So what you end up with, we pay anyway. We pay anyway through higher tuition fees or higher DMV fees. So we're paying more anyways, just trying to make people say, you know, why don't you pay for these services instead of, because we are going to have to pay at some point.
Well, we do have, we're in a bit of a chicken and egg stage right now, because at the very time when we're charging the gates on adult education and saying, you know, there are 60,000 people in the city of Fresno, for example, adults in the adult working population who don't have a basic high school diploma or GED. So we're trying to reach those 60,000 and say, education can happen for you. We're going to make it easy for you to get through the process. And then it's up to you to do the hard work necessary to get this basic step completed. At the very same time as we're saying that, of course, our public education system is completely hurting, as you've said, with lack of revenues and budget cuts. Thankfully, Fresno Unified has not cut its adult education program. And I'm so grateful to the board and to the leadership of the school district that they've said, look, you know, it'd be very easy to just cut this program and put those dollars into K-12, because we certainly need them there too. But we're not going to do that. We understand the importance of keeping some kind of programming available at Cesar Chavez Adult School and providing an opportunity for people to reenter and get a basic education or training. So it's a little bit, I mean, certainly it's a bottleneck right now, but that we can't let that stop us. We can't look at the recession and say, oh, you know what, everything's got to shut down. We're just going to stop trying to advance our community. Baloney. Look, other cities, other regions have gone through difficult times, whether it was the recession of the 80s or the 90s or whatever, and they've pushed through and they've been better off on the other side of it. And that's where Fresno has to stay focused.
Okay. And we talk about the training programs and education programs. That will help us long term. That's a long term fix for our situation. And everybody knows we need it. And we've just got to put the time in. But right now, a lot of folks are hurting. A lot of people don't have jobs. what do we do short term? What can we do short term when it comes to try to put people back to work?
Well, I would say, first of all, I don't think the focus on adult education is just a long-term issue. There are training and certification programs today that may be 8 or 9 week courses at Cesar Chavez or at Fresno City College that can prepare and equip somebody to get a job at the end of that 8 or 9 week period. So I think certainly it's a long-term to see mass change and get 60,000 people through to some kind of basic education level and beyond. But there is a short-term benefit to accessing training and education today as well. But to your point, how do we work on the job side? How do we make sure that our businesses are competing and they're out there growing and that sort of thing? Well, the city of Fresno, there's a couple things that we're focused on. First of all, we got to make sure that the city itself is not the problem. We know that there have been huge bottlenecks, and businesses who have wanted to expand here have found, 9 to 18 month delays in getting their permits through the city process. That is our responsibility at City Hall. We've got a huge effort underway to make sure that doesn't happen again. We're starting to get really good reports from businesses who are now doing business with us saying, boy, it's never been any better than it is now. I'm not satisfied with just those anecdotal reports, and we're working to make sure the culture changes at City Hall, our processes change, our policy changes, so that long term we are constantly in a growth mode and a positive, supportive attitude towards business. So that's underway for us. In addition to that, we're working with our food processors in the Fresno area that have the potential to expand here, working with them to make sure they've got adequate infrastructure, that if there's anything we can do at City Hall to help them, they know that we're there. And we've already seen, some pretty positive success stories. And, these companies, they'll add maybe 10 or 20 jobs at a time. And you think, well, that's not enough. We need tens of thousands, not 10 or 20. It adds up.
Yeah.
And for every one job that's filled at one of those companies, there's a multiplier effect in the local economy of at least another 2 to 3 jobs that get added simply because that one person now has discretionary income and they're spending it in the local market. So it's one of those things where you can't really see the great big movement yet, but little by little, I do see a shift happening with our export companies here in Fresno. That's very positive.
And high-speed rail is expected to have a huge impact.
In fact, it would. It's estimated that 20,000 jobs would be created during the construction of the initial construction segment in the Fresno area. That's over a 5-year period, 20,000 jobs a year for 5 years. So that certainly would have a significant impact. But I look at high-speed rail and think about the long-term economic value that gets added when Fresno businesses can get to LA and San Francisco in a little over an hour for $70, as opposed to paying $800 to $1,600 to get on a plane to go to either of those markets. I think of the travel and tourist potential for people coming through Fresno to access 3 national parks and incredible natural beauty all around us that, frankly, when I talk to people in San Francisco, they have no idea that we are a tourist destination location as well when you want to access national parks and natural beauty. But they never think to come here because they got to get in a car and drive 3.5 hours if they're lucky and they don't have traffic, or they have to spend, $900 on a plane ticket to get here. So the access issue for Fresno has been a longtime bottleneck. Not a week goes by that I don't hear from a business person asking when we're going to get Southwest Airlines in Fresno. Yeah. Unfortunately, the way the business models work for the airlines, there is no way anytime in the next 15 to 20 years that we would see Southwest in this market. High-speed rail changes that dynamic. And I think, when I hear people who are upset about high-speed rail, their biggest concern is they assume that the government's going to have to subsidize the operation of the rail line once it's in place because they say, well, Amtrak gets subsidized, so of course high-speed rail is going to as well. The problem with that is they're completely different business models. And every high-speed rail system that's operating in the world makes money today on its operations, has fully commercialized the operation of that high-speed rail line, and the private sector runs it. And so this is a potential project where the government puts up the upfront capital costs, But then the private sector takes it from there, and there is no subsidy, no operating subsidy of high-speed rail in other markets where it exists. And that's the business model that our California program is working on as well. So I think once people understand how this really is going to operate, they will – I don't think they'll be quite as concerned about it.
But, you know, how do you feel about some of that opposition? Because you've heard people say, well, the train to nowhere. How do you get them to look at this as this is just like us building any other long-term project?
You build
it in stages.
I think that's a good point. And I think when you look at it that way, for example, Interstate 5 took 50 years to build in California. And where did they start building first? In the Central Valley. They started in the middle of the state and worked outward. And it took 50 years to build. Now, the timetable on building out high-speed rail from the Bay Area to the L.A. Basin is, I don't know the number off the top of my head, much less than 50 years. Let's say it's probably 25 to 30 years. And frankly, once you have an initial operable segment up and running, whether that's Fresno to San Jose or Fresno to LA, at that point, private sector kicks in, private investment happens, and the rail starts to get extended, not just with public dollars, but with private dollars as well. So I think when people start to look at it that way, and when they realize if you don't put in high-speed rail, for example, you have to add, gosh, something like a dozen or more airline gates at our existing airports, none of which have room to expand. You have to spend $100 billion on highway lane miles just to accommodate the same number of passengers. When you look at it in that context, you start to see that high-speed rail offers an improved service, customer satisfaction levels that are off the charts in other markets where they exist. It operates without any kind of a subsidy. Even airlines have subsidies, as we know. And it's much more cost-effective than building additional highway lane miles or adding the air traffic.
Are you concerned that politics could derail this whole project? There's a lot of talk that, you know, that could happen.
Well, I think that I think that it's going to be tough to make the case and for people to really evaluate this without politics getting in the way. But I think that's what we have to do. And what I have encouraged people to consider is when you hear the criticism of high-speed rail, certainly there's legitimate criticism, issues, major questions that need to be answered and must be answered. And if they can't be answered in a satisfactory way, then nobody should support high-speed rail. But you need to filter out those kinds of legitimate questions from the political pot-stirring kind of thing that is just simply trying to tank a project because they don't like so-and-so or, you know, or whatever. So put that aside. And I just encourage the public, put that aside. Let's focus on what the legitimate issues are. Let's see if they can't be worked through from an engineering and from a business standpoint. And assuming they can be, then let's go for it. And if they can't be, would be the first one to admit that this is something that shouldn't move forward.
You know, we hear a lot about when we talk about high-speed rail, we talk about the construction and the construction jobs. But what other kind of jobs will come with this?
Well, I think just to build the facility itself, there are all kinds of occupations that are required to do it. And this would be the biggest infrastructure project, certainly in the state's history, and I've heard it told in our country's history as well. I guess it depends on the way you measure it. But designers, engineers, environmental technicians, attorneys, financial experts, all kinds of professional occupations, along with very, very high-skilled requirements for the construction itself. There will be, frankly, many development opportunities, businesses that will need to relocate. I'm hearing from some in the downtown area, for example, that are already saying they want to group together and go build a new development somewhere where they can all stay together, which is going to be a great development opportunity for a private property owner. There's going to be a significant ripple effect, I think, really across the board.
Are we already training and preparing people for these jobs?
There are certainly efforts to start up additional training capacity at our local community colleges and in other training programs. In addition to that, our building trades have very sophisticated, robust training programs that they'll have to ramp up. And I know that they're paying close attention and that they have plans to expand their training ability. Now, keep in mind that in the construction segment, it has been the hardest hit in the recession, and the unemployment rates are, gosh, I keep hearing numbers ranging between 35% and 50%.
Exactly.
So there are a lot of people who are skilled and who are trained and ready to go to work. In fact, the four-county labor market area here, there are tens of thousands of people that are skilled tradesmen and tradeswomen who are ready to go. I expect, obviously, we want to absorb as much of the work as possible here in this four-county area. And I expect that on top of that, there'll be probably people who will come in from other areas to help build the line as well.
Okay. Well, one thing I think that really kind of sets you apart is that you really do have a plan and a vision for Fresno. And when people hear your talk, you're very passionate about it. Some of that includes job growth, downtown redevelopment, improving our neighborhoods. How do you have to continue to work to get people to buy into this vision? Because, you know, so often they'll say, well, you know, I've heard that before. But you're really excited about where you see this city going.
I am. And if I wasn't, I wouldn't have signed up for this job. I think when I first started, probably the bigger challenge was cynicism. And boy, we've heard it before. And we don't really think it can happen for Fresno. And frankly, I think my predecessor, Mayor Autry, did a great job of kind of clearing out that type of thinking. And he really encouraged us as a city and as a community that we can be, we can achieve our goals. We can have a revitalized middle part of our city, as well as a thriving, you know, suburban area, which is beautiful right now, that has great amenities that people enjoy. We can do that. We can become an educated community. We can grow our local businesses. So I think there was some optimism that he planted in Fresno. I think today what we struggle with is, given the depth of the recession and the enduring nature of it, is just making sure that, number one, we're managing the resources we have as efficiently and effectively as possible, but at the same time, taking baby steps. And I'm not even suggesting we take giant steps right now, but taking baby steps towards the future as we get through this recession. And if we can get through the next 18 to 24 months, having done that, managing our resources really well, but keeping our eye on the ball of where we can go as a community, and just taking a few steps forward, we will have accomplished so much as a city. So I think that, you know, just constantly reminding people that it's both managing our resources well today, as well as taking baby steps towards the future. Let's just keep going inch by inch. I think that's really what's going to keep our community on track.
Okay. And people are going to have the opportunity to have input in what we see as far as trying to redevelop downtown.
In fact, there have been thousands of people involved in the last 18 months in putting together the downtown neighborhood community plan, as well as the Fulton Corridor specific plan, which will be released in the next couple of weeks. Our downtown neighborhood community plan was released on Friday of last week, and it was put together by property owners and residents in the neighborhoods who are affected, which is exactly what you would want to see happen. The people who have the skin in the game, who own the property, who have the vision for their neighborhoods, they got to articulate what they're looking for. And based on that vision, the city has to figure out, how do we provide the infrastructure to support the implementation of that vision.
Okay. Seems like there's a lot going on. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to stop in and talk to us about exactly where the city is and what's in store for the future.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, joining us now is Blake Kunzel, Executive Director of Fresno County Workforce Investment Board, and Chuck Riojas, President, IBEW Local 100. Now, these two gentlemen are on the front lines when it comes to high-speed rail jobs. You know, we're still in the debate of the pros and cons of high-speed rail, but these guys are moving ahead when it comes to job creation. Mr. Kunzel, we'll start with you. I understand that you are really busy defining what jobs high-speed rail will bring.
Yes, Juanita. It's interesting. We don't currently have anywhere in the United States a true high-speed rail system. So the ability to go to something that exists and say, okay, what jobs do you have, at least here in this country, it's not there. So in order to try to get our arms around or our mind around what are the actual jobs that are going to result from this rail system, we had to get in touch with China, France, Germany, Spain, And all those various countries and their national rail authorities have been very helpful in sending information to us, then get it translated and see where there were similarities in job postings to try to create an initial list of what the actual jobs are, both from the construction of the rail system and then its later maintenance and operations, kind of those three areas.
Okay. And what are some of the areas we're looking at? I mean, for us, where are the first jobs, let's say, because this is a long project, the first job's going to be?
Sure. I should say, too, that we're looking at jobs that cut across education levels and skill levels. So there's entry-level positions, and then there are jobs for engineering students and graduate students at Fresno State and at UC Merced. Right now, it's a really great question. Our office recently has been queried right-of-way agents. So the proposed rail line has been published. The environmental impact report is being commented on. And they're actually hiring the agents who are going to go out and negotiate with the property owners for their land or portions of their land. And so we were called by a number of people who were bidding on those contracts to say, do you know how we can find people who are appraisers or realtors or attorneys who are willing to work as right-of-way agents? So that's the very first phase. After that, you have employees who are called haulers and grubbers, kind of a non-fancy name. But they literally go in and clear things like brush and small trees and whatnot. And from there, it just kind of takes off exponentially, people to test the soil, to grade the soil. Initially, though, focused on all construction jobs up to the point that the rail gets laid and the trains are actually starting to run.
Okay. I have a question for you, Mr. Riojas. But first, I want to let the public in on this. You at home, do you think, let's say, the benefits or the jobs coming from high-speed rail is kind of worth what we as an area will have to go through to bring high-speed rail here? We'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 275-8989 or toll-free at 800-224-8989, or you can email us talk@kbpr.org. And Mr. Riojas, with the IBEW, now you have a group of young people who are at work right now preparing themselves for these possible jobs.
Yes, absolutely. We see a future in high-speed rail when it comes to construction projects, and we're working progressively to fill a pipeline with apprentices as well as pre-apprentices and getting people prepared for access to our apprenticeship programs within the building trades. We're looking with the sheet metal trades, the plumbing trades, and the electrical, and doing everything we can to prepare the public for these jobs that are up and coming.
Now, also one of the things, too, is people have to realize now the apprenticeship programs are, they're, what, 3-5-year programs. So if it's something that you want to get in on and be ready and prepared, you have to kind of do that now, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. We have entrance requirements, algebra being one of them, GED and diploma. But more importantly, yes, you have to prepare yourself for the future and make sure that you're prepared to enter into these apprenticeship programs. It's not a 4-year college institution, but it is a 5-year apprenticeship program. So you are dedicating yourself to a trade for 5 years. It's on-the-job training as well as academic.
Okay. And when you talk about preparing yourself, you did talk about, and that's been one of the problems, as we've mentioned in our last report, really young people having prepared themselves with the proper education, with basic skills, including algebra.
Yeah, when they took voc ed out of the high schools, that was a very unfortunate situation, understanding that they had budget constraints and things that they had to eliminate, I guess. But what it did, it allowed the building trades to step up and come up with a pre-apprenticeship program or just a program or a process for those individuals that weren't looking to a college degree. And it's not a step backwards to enter the trades by any means, but it is another avenue towards a career path.
Okay. And Mr. Consul, one of the concerns people have voiced is about really having the workforce to fill these jobs. So many people are concerned that we could start the project here and we might have to go outside the area to get workers. And that's a huge concern since we have so many people here who are out of work. Do you think we're going to be able, by the time we start this project, that we're going to have the workforce needed?
I know that we'll have the workforce needed for a percentage of the jobs. I mean, in reality, you know, when this thing is at full bore, there could be 8,000-10,000 workers in all the various subfields working on different portions of this project. We have proposed to the State Rail Authority, and they're getting it reviewed right now by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Federal Rail Authority, language that would allow for a certain percentage of the jobs coming from the project to be aimed at areas of long-term high unemployment. Fresno and many of the Valley counties would fit under kind of that rubric. So we're waiting to hear that. Over and above that, though, we're asking for some transparency rules in whatever contractors are chosen as how they hire. And I'll give you a short example. A number of years ago, there was a prison that was built in Mendota, a federal prison. And people came out and said, this prison is going to be good for the city. There'll be construction jobs. After that, there'll be jobs at the prison and there'll be hotels around it. This is about 9 years ago. I was new then. So I contacted the construction company to see how we would refer people from Fresno to get those jobs. A contractor from Arizona was chosen, and the only way to apply for those jobs was to physically go down to a trailer at their yard in Maricopa County in Arizona to apply. So one of the things that we're recommending to the Rail Authority is that whatever contractors are chosen, they have to have a physical hiring office within the construction zone. They publish job postings 30 days before they have to be filled. That those listings be shared with organizations like ours, workforce boards, community colleges, and areas where people might go to get public information. So we kind of have a two-phase approach. One is transparency rules so that people in Fresno and other Valley communities have a chance to compete. And then two, because we are an area of long-term high unemployment, that a certain percentage of jobs, all things being equal, would be reserved for those workers.
Okay. I have a question for both of you, and I'm sure this is for people. When you get right down to it, this is what people want to know. What do I have to do to get one of those jobs, to be in line for one of those jobs? If you were a person out there right now, what would you be doing?
The job, as I mentioned, the jobs are going to pick up sequentially. So we're looking at right-of-way agents now, and then they're going to kind of go into it. Also, too, there's a two-phase process for how the contractors are going to be chosen. An RFQ is being released this week. Qualified bidders will be determined, and then those bidders will be allowed to compete in a formal RFP. I know with the Workforce Board, once we know who the contractors are, we are going to trumpet that information in Fresno and all over the Valley. So they could use us as an information resource, but we won't be the only one. Our community college partners, EOC, we're going to share this information with everybody. And wherever they put that physical hiring office, you know, we're going to probably tie balloons to it so that people know how to get there. So ground must be broken next year in order for the Rail Authority to draw down that federal money. And
exactly.
I would bet the farm that ground will get broken so that that money can be drawn down. So, but obviously we're just at the start of that type of sequential process. People have to look. They have to keep their eyes open.
Yeah, they do, because they have been having informational meetings. You've just got to be hooked in and tied into this. And you, Mr. Rijohas, what would you recommend?
Yeah, basically for us in the trades, it would just be a good firm foundation in algebra. If you've taken algebra in high school with a passing grade and feel that you didn't fully grasp it or it's been a few years since high school, I would recommend going to adult school or State Center Community Colleges, taking a year of algebra, coming in and taking the respective assessment tests for the electrical, plumbing, and the sheet metal. Basically, with that, clean DMV and a high school diploma or GED, just prepare yourself to take that entrance exam, be prepared to take an interview, and get on our hiring list.
Okay. Because, people think that it's easy to get into an apprenticeship program, and sometimes it's really not. I understand you all now are reaching out to young people who might need a little bit more to enter into the program.
Yes, absolutely. We've engaged with the Fresno City and County Housing Authority, and we conducted a pre-apprenticeship program for them and the Section 3 housing clients that they had. And so we were successful in our first phase of that. That has right now put four Section 3 clients into our respective programs, two in the electrical industry, one in the plumbing, and one in the sheet metal. What we've done, and we started yesterday, was a pre-apprenticeship program for the county of Fresno. And those are the Jumpstart program or the Welfare to Work recipients. And so what we are allowing them to do is participate in this four-week program, and they automatically qualify for interview for placement on our lists.
Okay. So there is work being done. We all recognize the problem of trying to get people who may not have
the right skills brought into the workforce. And there seems to be a huge effort along those lines.
Yes, I think that what Chuck was getting at too, though, is a lot of times we have a huge number of unemployed people in our county right now, and I would encourage them to take advantage of the fact that they're unemployed. I'm not trying to say that to be cute or trite, but basically if you've got time on your hands and you don't have a GED or you don't have a high school diploma,
then
by God, go get it.
Yes.
Something that sounds even more puerile is we do a lot of screening. We work closely with the unions. We have a huge program with PG&E. I can't tell you the number of people who, as we screen prospective workers, are failing drug tests. You know what? Now's a good time to clean up.
Yeah.
Because this, you know, no one's going to let you use a piece of heavy equipment or anything like that if you're not a responsible person. So, I mean, I think you have to take a self-assessment of where you are and then look and see how you can improve. And if you got time on your hands because you're unemployed, if not now, when?
Right. No, I think that's some great advice. And I thank both of you for coming in. I hope people take it to heart and use the time that they have wisely. You can always learn something new. Thank you both. We really appreciate having you in here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome back. This is Valley Edition. 100 years ago this month, California's experiment in direct democracy was born with the introduction of the ballot initiative and referendum process. Now, a century later, Californians are again looking at new ideas to fix what many feel is a broken system in Sacramento. So what might the next 100 years have in store? Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
I love you, California. You're the greatest state of all.
If you take a moment to compare California of 2011 to that of 1911, the differences are huge. Back then, the state was home to only 2 million people, and Hollywood, industrial-scale agriculture, and Silicon Valley simply didn't exist. But there's also some striking similarities to the present day, at least politically.
I think that the state capital is just as much controlled by special interests today as it was 100 years ago. You know, it may not be one single interest, but the rules of the game haven't changed.
That's Kim Alexander, president and founder of the nonprofit California Voter Foundation.
It still takes a lot of money to run for office. The Capitol is filled with lobbyists, and the legislative docket is filled with bills that are sponsored by lobbying groups and industries. And that was true 100 years ago, and it's true today.
Back then, Sacramento was controlled by the powerful Southern Pacific Railroad. California voters responded to the situation by electing a reform-minded governor, Hiram Johnson, who led the charge to let citizens take lawmaking into their own hands. The result was the initiative, the referendum, and the recall. In the past 10 decades, thousands of initiatives have qualified for the ballot, and while a relatively small number have actually become law, the process remains popular.
Most Californians think that the initiative process does a better job at making policy than the governor and the legislature.
That's Mark Baldessari, president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. In the organization's most recent opinion poll, released last month, 62% of Californians said they're satisfied with the initiative process. Compare that to the state legislature, which received an approval rating of just 26%. If voter dissatisfaction a century ago created such dramatic reforms, some suggest the current climate might do the same.
We're living now in an era of reform in California. We've seen a number of reforms take shape and get approved by the voters in the last few years, including the open primary and redistricting and a simple majority for passing the budget. I think voters feel that more changes are needed.
So what types of changes might be in store? A lot of them take direct aim at the state legislature. Jim Boren, editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee, is among those advocating for a return to the part-time legislature that California had until 1966.
You know, they're a pretty pampered bunch, and they're out of touch. And I think a part-time legislature would reconnect with the public in a way that would improve governance in California.
In July, a LA Times USC poll of California voters found that 65% supported the idea of making the legislature part-time.
The public's for it, and the politicians are against it. I think that bodes well.
But the list of reforms doesn't stop there. Another idea is taking the state Senate and the Assembly and creating one legislative body.
There's 40 members of our state Senate. It makes it hard to draw districts for a state of almost 40 million people. What about the idea of having 120 members, combining the numbers in the state Senate with the Assembly in the context of perhaps other reforms? A single body with smaller districts might lead to better governance.
Jim Boren agrees.
We don't need a duplicate system where we have to do everything twice with twice the staffs and twice that. I mean, the idea that we have a House and a Senate and the Constitution was part of the Great Compromise. We're only mimicking what was in the federal government. We only need one House. Nebraska has it, does just fine.
Other less dramatic reforms could also be on the horizon, some even involving previous attempts at fixing Sacramento, like the state's term limits law. Critics have said the law has caused a lack of institutional memory in the legislature, strengthened the role of lobbyists, and has created a never-ending quest for higher office.
What happens is the lobbyists aren't termed out, the bureaucrats aren't termed out, but the lawmakers are. So the good lawmakers move on.
According to Baldessari, the limits remain popular.
Most voters are pleased with the fact that we've got term limits in place since 1990, but that doesn't mean that they don't think that there could be changes that might make that process better.
In the new PPIC poll, 6 in 10 voters supported the concept of changing the current limit of 8 years in the state Senate and 6 in the Assembly to a total of 12 years in any of the two houses together. An initiative to that effect has already qualified for the 2012 ballot. Even the initiative process itself is not without its problems and potential fixes.
You know, the problem is we're making initiative policy in a vacuum, and voters aren't really being given a full picture the way the legislature is when they pass a budget. You know, they're looking at the whole budget of the whole state and all the programs. Voters are just looking at one proposal at a time. And there are reforms circulating within the legislature and bills that are on the governor's desk that would attempt to help voters sort out the cost of initiatives in advance before they actually vote.
Jim Boren says he'd like to see more transparency in the process to determine legal and fiscal problems with initiatives before Californians vote on them.
I'd like to see a system where if an initiative is qualified for the ballot, that it has to have legislative hearings so you can find out the problems in it.
But regardless of the changes that may come to state government in the coming years, one thing is certain. California's century-old initiative process isn't going anywhere.
Californians have a love-hate relationship with the initiative process. I mean, we love to complain about it, but don't you dare talk about taking it away.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Your dear mountain I adore. I love your grand old ocean, and I love her rugged shore.
Well, speaking of changes to the initiative process, Governor Jerry Brown has until Sunday to decide whether or not to sign a new Senate bill that would ban ballot initiatives from the June 12th primary or the June 2012 primary election and shift them to the general election in November. Joining us now is Dan Schnurr. He is the director of the Unruh Institute of Politics at USC. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Schnurr.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, hopefully you heard that last question. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Do you think the governor is going to sign this Senate bill that would ban initiatives from our June 12th primary election?
Well, it has to be very, very tempting for Governor Brown to sign the bill. Number one, the Constitution originally stated that initiatives would only be heard during a general election, and ironically, it was Secretary of State Jerry Brown that helped reverse that process and expand it to primaries back in the 1970s. But he is under a great deal of pressure from Democrats in the legislature who are worried about initiatives qualifying for the next ballot that they believe would be of aid to the Republican Party and its followers. And having those initiatives on the ballot with a lower voter turnout would greatly increase their chances of passing.
Okay, and we would like to hear from our listeners. What do you think? Do you think a part-time legislature would work, or legislature would work? Give us a call here at 559-275-8989 or toll-free at 1-800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kbpr.org your thoughts on a part-time legislature. Is that something you would like to see the state move to? And back to Mr. Schnur. One thing, we hear this all the time. Whenever the public gets fed up with the government, they pass an initiative to try to address that frustration. We saw it with term limits this past election year. We saw it with redistricting. Is that process really the answer? Is the initiative process really the answer?
Well, I guess I'd broaden the question, if you don't mind, which is to take it to the point, is any political reform a magic answer to all of the state's problems? And the answer is no. And well-meaning people, I think, have worked very hard, and correctly so, to overhaul the state's redistricting process. As your package noted, there's an effort to reform the way term limits are done in the state. We passed an open primary. You can make a case for all of these various reforms, but none of them are magic solutions. Basically, what a political reform does at its best is it opens up the opportunity for change. And so, in other words, changing the initiative process won't magically make California's economy come back. It won't magically make our schools better. But depending on what you think of the particular reform, it could make it easier for voters to have their voices heard when they're frustrated by the lack of progress in Sacramento.
Well, then if we take a look at what you're saying, then we'd have to say that the problem is the legislature itself then.
Well, we should be fair to them. I mean, it's not a particularly well-respected body, and they go out of their way in all sorts of ways not to cover themselves with glory. But if you ask every single member of the California State Legislature to faithfully vote for the preferences of his or her constituents, the result will be gridlock. We have a state that's very diverse, and that diversity brings all sorts of tremendous strengths. But diversity of opinion makes compromise a little bit more difficult. Now, the redistricting reforms that were enacted in the last election, which we should see the results of after the 2012 elections are passed, the top two primary and other reforms have been instituted to try to make the legislature a little bit less polarized. But on balance, if you put someone from Fresno and you put someone from San Francisco in a room and tell them to compromise, you're putting a pretty big challenge in front of both of them.
And we can see where that leads. It's been difficult, especially if we take a look at what's happened during the last election year and the few last election years. Whichever party dominates in the legislature, that's what we end up having. Because, as you mentioned, the other party or some of the other members of the other party will not compromise. So some are saying then we don't need a two-body legislature. I mean, is that a solution?
You know, it may be. I mean, one of the most legitimate criticisms of the state legislature is you're asking an awful lot of 120 people to represent the wishes of 38 million constituents. Our state senators have larger districts than most members of Congress do, and if you ask a member of the state Senate to represent, you know, several million people, that really does undermine the idea of representative democracy. Now, there is a burgeoning initiative effort out of Southern California which would dramatically expand the legislature in order to make the members true citizen legislators. But at that point, you're talking about a legislative body of thousands of people. So at the very least, taking these 120 members and distributing them more evenly across the state geographically might lead to some more responsiveness on the part of their members. But if you're going to have a state this big, one of the things that comes with that is a fairly difficult expectation on the part of our elected representatives to hear and listen and respond to what several million of their constituents want to hear.
So that makes it difficult. I mean, what are some of the solutions?
Well, I do think that the redistricting reforms that we'll see in place for this next set of elections is a good step in the right direction. You can't create 120 competitive legislative districts because and you don't need to. But one thing we saw in Sacramento in the 1990s, when the state Supreme Court stepped in and drew the lines rather than the legislature, is that if you have even a dozen, 14, 15 members of the legislature who cluster toward the political center, that makes negotiating across party lines a lot easier. Think of it this way. You have a governor, whether it's Brown or Schwarzenegger, whether it's Wilson or Davis, standing on or near the 50-yard line of politics. You have the ideological caucuses standing in their respective ideological end zones. If you've ever tried to negotiate with someone standing 100 yards away, it's pretty tough. So not to suggest that moderates or centrists are superior, or for that matter inferior, to principled liberals or conservatives, but I think if you do have even a small number of centrists in the state legislature, number one, it does represent the ideological diversity of the state, and it does make it a little bit easier for the two parties to work together.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us this morning. We appreciate your comments.
Thank you for having me.
We have been talking to Mr. Dan Schnur, director, the Unruh Institute of Politics at USC. We'll be right back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. The Fresno League of Women Voters will be participating in a national education study looking at what role the federal government has in education. Leading up to the study, the League is holding workshops, and here to talk about how you can have your voice heard is Jackie Canville. Mrs. Canville is not only an educator, she is also the co-chair of the National Education Study. Now, Jackie, can you tell us what will the study look like? What is it looking at?
Well, as you know, the League of Women Voters, we study issues before we actually advocate for anything. And we have an education position, but we believe it's important to relook at our positions to see if, you know, things change. Like, there's been a lot of change in the federal government and how they are participating in public education. And so the National League said that all leagues around the United States should look at this matter. So we're looking not only at the history of the federal government involved in public education, but also we're looking also at the way that they are funding education, and should there be specific funding for certain types of items, for example, special education or early childhood.
And so this is really kind of particularly important this year because of the changes taking place with No Child Left Behind.
Exactly. You know, the League always is on the forefront of things. This decision was made more than a year ago. And as you know, currently in the last, you know, couple months, you know, we've seen changes at the federal government level where they're announcing additional flexibility for states, you know, on the No Child Left Behind. And so this is very timely.
Okay. And the federal government does have, it plays a huge role in our education system.
They do. But it's really interesting that the way our Constitution is set up is that it's really more to the states, you know, on doing it. But with the No Child Left Behind, it has brought all of the states to come up with standards. And the federal government is realizing this and realizing that they need to be part of the solution. And so that's why they're having some flexibility in their standards.
And we've also seen the one, No Child Left Behind, was put forth by former President Bush. And now with President Obama, we see race to the top.
We definitely do. And that also brought in competition amongst states to get involved in their individual children to want to raise up their level of efforts. But the whole question is should we have race to the top? Should we make sure that all children are educated across all the United States? So that's actually one thing the League's looking at is, you know, do we, you know, spear competition? Do we set standards? You know, the whole issue, you know, is a very interesting topic.
Now, you are going to have workshops leading up to this study, and you're having a workshop tomorrow night.
Yes. What we decided to do, we knew that education is something on the forefront of everyone's minds. And to better inform us and the public, we're having two workshops. And the first one tomorrow is going to feature three of our local superintendents. It'll have Superintendent Mike Hansen from Fresno Unified. Also, we'll have Superintendent Larry Powell from Fresno County Office of Education and Superintendent Juan Garza from Kings County Unified. So you'll see we'll get an urban look, a rural look, and a county oversight perspective.
Okay. And what will the public, how will the public be able to participate in this?
Well, we're first going to start off with the superintendents giving us their feel on what they think the role of the federal government should be in public education. And we're hoping to have a conversation and steering their conversation amongst all the different kinds of topics that we've talked about here today. But then we are going to open it up for the public to be able to ask questions of one or all of them so that they can get a feel for how they think things should work.
Now, for the study, you're saying you're having these two workshops leading up to the study. What is going to, because it's not just, you know, the local league, this is a national study, correct?
Correct.
What will your role be when it comes to conducting that study? How do you go about that?
Well, after the two workshops, and we're having one, you know, tomorrow, as you said, you know, at the First Congressional Church from 4 to 6, and then in the second one, October 26, which will feature some additional speakers that will go more into the topic. We're bringing Janelle Kumachek from West Ed out of Sacramento, who's very knowledgeable about the subject and is part of the advocate for helping school districts implement NCLB. And then Dave Calhoun from Fresno Unified, who is over research evaluation assessment to help us understand all those tests.
So you're trying to get both of the workshops in during the month of October because
correct.
You've got to start this in November, correct?
Correct. And then our study is in November. And that is open to league members. Obviously, you know, if someone wants to become a league member, they can. We're open to males and females. It only costs $60 a year. But what we'll do before we answer any questions is we'll get information presented to all of our members. And that actually, all that information is on our website if anyone would like to go to that. And we'll hear all the information, and then we'll get questions asked of us, and then we'll talk about them. And then when we come to consensus, then we'll submit our results to the National League, who will compile all the results from all around the United States. And then at the next National Convention of the League of Women Voters, they will decide on if we're going to update our position or not.
Okay. Well, let's go back. You have two events coming up, and we want to make sure people have information on that. The first workshop is tomorrow morning again. I mean, tomorrow
afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Where and what are the times on that?
It's from 4 to 6 at the First Congressional Church, which is at 2131 North Venice, the Big Red Church. And we invite the public to participate, not only in this one, but that will feature the three superintendents that we talked about earlier, but also on October 26th, same time, 4 to 6, same place, First Congressional Church. And that has the two speakers I mentioned previously and also Dr. Tony Monreal, who was at the state CDE and is currently at Porterville Unified as their assistant human resources director.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Jackie Canville with the Fresno League of Women Voters. And we hope everybody will see you tomorrow late afternoon.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weber, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.